Hi, Sarah.
Hello.
So, how's the being a starving artist going?
Oh, I tell you, the artist bit is brilliant. Yeah, it's fantastic. Ooh. It's the absolute best. Yeah, I feel inspired. I'm collaborating. I'm creating.
And starving.
Yeah, I'm starving. Yeah, there is that, yeah.
That is the downside.
Mm. Yeah.
Well, I've been looking into things, and I think you might need something called a business plan.
Well, business, I can do that.
Oh, yes, yes, you can. But there's a whole subject on this, really, really, yeah? On how to look at all the figures and...
Wait, maths? I can't do maths.
There's a little bit of that, yeah. But organising, being entrepreneurial...
I can do that. Yeah, well, let's look at this business thing right now, can we? I'm hungry for this.
Literally.
Yes.
Hello and welcome to the Audio Drama Production Podcast. I'm Fiona.
And I'm Sarah. And today we're very excited to be looking at a variety of business models that people use in the audio drama world and how it might perhaps appeal to you to choose one over the other. We've been lucky enough to speak to Mr. David K. Barnes and Liz Campbell of Wooden Overcoats. And we've also heard from Mariella, haven't we, from the Wireless Theatre?
We have indeed, yes. And they've got great different ways of approaching it, in fact.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. So regarding sort of new setups and things, there are obviously several ways of potentially getting help to finance your exciting adventures in the audio world. So one of those is the Kickstarter model, isn't it? So using crowdfunding to try and get some money behind you as you're creating your exciting project. How do you feel about Kickstarter? Have you backed any projects? Fiona,
yes, I have actually. Mm. And it's a nice way of feeling involved, really. I like the, with Kickstarter and with GoFundMe as well, they offer different sort of levels. And depending on your support, then there will be some kind of, I was going to say toy, some sort of...
Reward, yeah.
That's the word.
There you go.
Yes. That's the one. Not toys. I honestly don't just bid on toys.
We all like a good toy, Fiona. That's not.
But it can be anything, can't it? From a badge to an episode early, some sort of extra feature, something like that.
Yeah.
And it's a nice way of supporting a podcast that you really enjoy.
Yeah. And I think Liz talks about that in her interview, so we won't spoil what she's got to say, but there's lots of fun things that they, as Wooden Overcoats, had offered people that I think are really quite fun. And, you know, as she's spoken about, just not extra cost other than asking your actors to perhaps record something else. So, I think there's a lot of really good things to come out of Kickstarter. And I think it basically seems to be as well important to be very organised before, so you're not completely relying on the Kickstarter to give you some financial money. I think you do need to have something in reserve already so that you've got, you know, can at least make the project with what you've got, and that the Kickstarter would help with the kind of extras.
Absolutely.
And I just think it's a really easy way of getting, you know, your support behind some podcasts. And I haven't seen actually many people recently who, you know, have got working podcasts up and running, kind of using that. So it does seem to be something that's used right at the beginning of your series. And then obviously, I guess, then if you do go into running some more, then you can, you know, run some more further Kickstarter extravaganzas. Yep. But I've never used GoFundMe. Have you had experience with that one?
I haven't, no. I've only used Kickstarter at the moment, but I'm sure, yeah, people out there, if you have used GoFundMe, yeah, do have a chat with us on the Audio Drama Production Podcast Facebook page, perhaps, or on Twitter about it, and let us know your experiences.
Yeah, that would be amazing. I think the problem with the reward system is that. I think some people have run into the issue that their things have been physical things that they actually need to, you know, mail out and do things with. And I think it's really important to think about how cost effective your time is to dealing with sending out however many little lovely stickers, badges or homemade cakes to people might be. So that's something definitely to do. But then also I think people love that kind of homemade, handmade touch to things, that it means that, you know, they have an extra in with the producers and makers of the programme. So yes, I think it is very much a different model of using Kickstarter for whatever you want to get out of and put into your product, don't you think?
Yeah, absolutely. And in fact, there was one podcast that I did support, and I just happened to put the amount for a badge.
Yeah.
And the badge got lost in the post, but the envelope came, all opened up, but the envelope came, but they'd stamped the envelope so beautifully that actually that was enough. I was incredibly happy because I'd supported them anyway, and that's what I wanted to do, you know, at the end of the day.
Gone around wearing the envelope instead, yeah?
Yeah, wearing the envelope. But no, but very seriously, I don't know, there was something very lovely and touching, you know, about...
personal touch, isn't it?
It is.
Because there's a lot of talk about Patreon as well, isn't there? And obviously we have got a lovely, amazing, thank you very much, Patreon supporters.
We do, thank you.
You know, this, we wouldn't be doing this if they hadn't able to help support. So so feel free to help donate. We would love to be able to produce some more fun things for you. But yeah, I think Patreon is a fascinating thing. And again, you know, it's about getting that balance right with how much you're able to kind of give back and what you do. And I know some people are very proactive in, you know, saying my Patreons will get this episode so many days later. You're going to get this bonus content, which nobody else can hear for months and months. And I've kind of been seething because I've wanted to listen to some things, but I, you know, I donate various places. So, you know, you can't give to everyone. And, you know, and currently voice acting, I do a lot of free stuff. So I feel like, you know, you're kind of giving in that way. And so, yeah, I just think maybe there's, you know, so many things that you can give back to your Patreon supporters potentially.
Yeah.
That, you know, will hopefully encourage others to help support your project.
Absolutely. Another way of doing it, which Marielle, in fact, is going to talk about, so I won't talk too much first, is the paywall, which is another way of making enough money again to keep your podcast going.
Yeah.
Sometimes with some groups, they might offer maybe the first episode free or one episode free, and then the rest is behind the paywall, which then listeners who are enticed that way can go.
Yeah. And I've actually not followed through with investing in that. But I mean, I think, you know, with some places you pay sort of 25 British pounds for a year's access. And you know, in the grand scheme of things, that's pretty good. You know, I mean, you may think that's a big outlay in some respects, but actually thinking about some of the content you're going to get, I just think that is probably worth that investment.
It is very good value, actually, isn't it? Over spread over the year.
Yeah. And it's working out as well, you know, how much each podcast would be worth numerically per episode as well. I think that's quite interesting. Like, would you charge £4.50 for something that had someone's a named actor in it, whereas you charge 20p if it was me, or actually make me pay to be in it? I don't know.
She's breaking out from the paywall. Which actually brings us to another option, which is individual pay to download episodes. So you could individually price them rather than having a blanket wall, to mix metaphors, for the whole year.
Yeah, absolutely. So, yeah, there's lots of potential options with that. And also, you know, on top of that, there's the potential sponsorship excitement and extravaganza, which is a whole hotbed of mad information with so many things, I think, involved that kind of I feel a bit daunted by sponsorship, to be honest. Just working out, you know, how many podcasts worth you could have something in, and you know, how much that remuneration wise would, you know, come back to you. And I have fathomed there's a website called Midroll. I don't know if you've Heard of that one?
Yeah, I've heard of that. Mm. They, I believe, am I right, they will sort out the advertising for you. So you still okay the companies that you want to be associated with your podcast, yeah, and which you feel are sort of suitable for that. But they actually, once you give them your listenership figures and your projected figures, they will then arrange those.
Yeah, they sort out your advertisers. How cool is that? So, yeah, it's quite an interesting way of, yeah, cutting out lots of hundreds of hours work for yourself, potentially. I'm sure there's other, yeah, sites out there, but that's one I've come across.
Yeah, in the grand scheme, we'll put a link to that on the website.
Yes.
For anyone interested. Or, of course, you can approach sponsors yourself. If you are doing a production all about pianos, maybe there is a
chocolate. Just get chocolate to sponsor everything.
Mm. Chocolate. Oh, yes, chocolate. Actually, that's a very good idea. Just make your podcast about something that you really love as an audio drama. Mm. And then approach a sponsor who you feel is possibly suitable for that position.
Yeah. Yeah. Mm. And we all like to be in a strong position. But yes, I think there's a lot of kudos behind as well, you know, potentially getting the specific advertisers, but some might be quite obscure. And I think the worry about sponsorship, isn't it, and advertising is that it's frustrating for listeners. And I think this is something people battle with, it seems, quite a lot. It's like, where do I put this advert? Do I put it first? Do I put it last? Do I put it sporadically in the middle? Do I make up fake adverts in between these real adverts? And it's quite fascinating to think, you know. And I don't know about you, I just think maybe that, you know, there is no one correct model. It depends on what you specifically want, and maybe you can get feedback from your listeners as to fathom if it's working, if you want to listen to your listeners, because there is that too, because after all it is your product, isn't it?
Yeah, but as much as it is yours, it is theirs as well. And I think actually this is going to come up in the interviews again. We don't want to spoil them. But that kind of connection with your listeners, that kind of, yeah, it is actually quite a vital part, because yes, it is our, you know, your show, but you need the listeners to be connecting with that and with the brand and with your production company.
Yep.
In order for them to want to listen to it, you know.
Yeah, yeah. And I guess as well, it depends on your reach as well, you know, as in how many listeners you have and how much downloading is happening and across how many listeners, as to how, yeah, much sponsorship you will potentially get. Is it worth their while to sell their stuff with your artistic product? So, yeah.
And from what I've read, it does seem to be a single contract in each case. Mm. So it is something that, you know, individually you will be able to negotiate. And like you say, the more listeners you have, yep, the more likely you are to get the lucrative sponsorships.
Mm. No, absolutely. So if anyone does make chocolate and wants to sponsor us, we don't mind.
What, here at the Audio Drama Chocolate Production Podcast? Absolutely.
Now you're talking. Oh my lord. But yeah, I think there are so many exciting things happening, and you know, there's a variety of models out there, isn't there? And I think it's very much up to you as the producer and your team as to what works. And I think what's fascinating is there are a lot of one woman, one man teams out there, aren't they, doing everything. And it's like, if you don't know about sponsorship and advertising and things, then I think perhaps the best thing to do is to connect with people that are doing that.
Yes.
Because I'm sure if you're a producer, you're listening to lots of other things too, and you hear about these people doing these things. So perhaps, you know, we're all about connecting here, aren't we? We're about communicating. So just reach out and speak and say, look, I'm thinking of doing this. What do you recommend? And I think currently the ethos seems that everyone is very much about, you know, helping each other level up. So heartily recommend speaking to each other in lovely, nice little voices there.
Totally. And also, I think with all of this, even before you're going for the funding, you need to be really, really organised. And in fact, from our contributors today, the thing that really is very similar with all of them is their organisation and their focus on everything. You need to be sorting out your budget in advance. So you're going to be working out exactly what you're paying for the humans writing and acting and producing on it and post-producing, and also for counting all sorts of costs from studio fees and equipment and the hosting and the music and sound effects. Are you going to buy them or make them? Advertising that we've talked about, snacks, things like that.
Yeah, live show, hire of places, bar bills. The list is endless, isn't it?
It really is. but you do need a really concrete, sensible figure. And then when you have that, that's what you can build your whole plan around.
Yeah, so hunt around, I think, is the general advice I think we were talking about earlier, wasn't it? Is basically look at models on Kickstarter that have worked. Look at, you know, current successes like Wooden Overcoats and see, you know, how they've adapted their dreams and wishes to creating what is actually happening, you know, in several series on and some very professionally produced, amazingly well-received pieces. So yes, and it's a question as well, you know, reach where to place your work and, you know, iTunes-wise, Stitcher and, you know, a Tumblr and so on and so forth. Where is it going to reach those people so that you can hopefully build that audience to immense proportions?
Yeah. So without further ado, let's hear some examples of successful business models. Marielle Ranaker-Temple of Wireless Theatre Company was kind enough to send us this insight into her production company.
Hi, I'm Marielle. I run the Wireless Theatre Company. I'm the founder and artistic director of the company and the only full-time member of staff who works for the company. I started Wireless Theatre when I graduated from drama school. A few years after I graduated from drama school, I'd enjoyed success at drama school in audio acting, and I really loved it and wanted it to be a possible future route for me. But I found there not very much work available to me, and it was quite a closed market. I think it still is in some ways, but for me, the idea of producing your own work was always appealing to me. So my dad actually came up with the idea of downloadable radio drama, and to me that seemed great. We didn't know what we were doing. We started with a very small website, and a bunch of pals put together some audio drama. We'd never made anything before. We read a couple of books, we hired a studio, and we just set about recording our first couple of plays. What problems or issues did we come across a startup that new audio drama companies might have problems with? For us, it was website. You know, I'm going back 10 years now, and I had no idea how to run a website. Certainly the modern versions of Wix or other websites that seem to be very easy to build weren't around, so I had to hire someone to build the website, which cost money, not a lot but some, and then making a website that doesn't crash every time someone tries to download something, etc., etc., that looks good, was a big challenge for me, but an exciting one, and I enjoyed it. Something took me by surprise every day when I first started doing it. You know, downloadable radio drama was very, very new. There weren't very many companies doing it at all, and our content was all free. People really wanted it. There was a big audience from it right from the word go, but there wasn't a lot of other companies who I could go to for advice. Even Radio 4 weren't doing any of their online stuff, really. So it was kind of feeling around in the dark to see A, whether there was an audience at all, and B, you know, how to make it a really good user experience with basically £0 and zero pence. And it wasn't necessarily a good user experience at the beginning. I think the website was messy and confusing, but yet people did still download, which goes to show that audience were there and keen to get the content. For many years, we were a free model, and we kept all the content free, and you didn't even have to sign up. You literally just downloaded or streamed as you went. But the more and more in love with radio drama production I fell, the more I realised it was not going to be sustainable that way. I could donate every minute of my life in the beginning to it, and I wanted to do that. But eventually life got in the way. The need to earn money in a day job, the need to see the light of day, because it's very all consuming when you get involved with a project like this, as any audio drama producer will know. And I wanted to keep the quality of work good. I think you live and die by the quality of the work that you create. And I really wanted to make sure that stayed consistent. And the only way to do that would be to keep using good quality people. I wrote to as many actors as I could think of who had been on TV or radio, who I respected, to see if they would lend me their expertise, give me some money, become involved in some way. I was overwhelmed by the response with that. You know, huge actors who I'd loved since a child, Stephen Fry, Nicholas Parsons, Prunella Scales, all of those people lent their voices or their names to the company, which obviously gave it gravitas from quite early on, really. And to keep up with that level of quality that had become expected from us was getting harder and harder with no income. So the company wasn't making any income at all, although we had a really good subscriber base of people who signed up to the website to listen. All the content remained free. Eventually, we went to a paywall model simply because we just couldn't keep going. So it was that or probably end up calling it quits. And I definitely didn't want to do that because I could really see a future for online audio drama. I won't pretend that putting a paywall up did wonders for the company, because it didn't. It certainly raised the profile, I think, in the industry, and I think that was great, but our listeners dropped significantly, but perhaps not unexpectedly. I think it's expected for anyone who starts off free and then ends up charging for their content. Even though we were only charging £1.49 per play, the simple act of people having to sign up and depart with their money caused a lot of people to leave. However, slowly we have built those people up. We have less subscribers, but they are very loyal and they do enjoy the plays that we produce, and it has allowed us to put money back into the company to pay everybody involved and to keep up producing good quality work. We also have income from workshops, which we do in schools and colleges. We record voice reels for schools and colleges. We do live recordings several a year, although they don't bring in masses of money. They are a good way to raise awareness for what your company does. And we also are lucky enough to produce multicast long content dramas for Audible, Radio 4 and various other external companies. Working for them is wonderful and has changed our my company really quite significantly. How proactive am I at marketing your products? We do it online because it's free. We've never had any money to put into marketing. And again, when we first started, we became very high up in the Google rankings of audio drama because there wasn't a lot of it online, so it wasn't hard to do. I worked obsessively on the website, absolutely meticulously learning about search engine optimization and Google rankings, etc. Hours and hours and hours of my time was spent on that, as well as creating the dramas. I also swapped links. I wrote to any company that looked like it had anything to do with radio drama just to tell them of our existence. Those first few years, I was 100% dedicated and totally obsessed with the Wireless Theatre brand, convinced that there was a whole world out there of audio drama listeners who didn't even know that they loved audio drama, but would find that out as soon as they came across us. And to a certain extent, judging by the last 3 years of audio drama fans that are growing and growing, and producers that are growing and growing, I think that, you know, that is very true. So we do live recordings. We do social media, Facebook, Twitter. I'm very active on Twitter, at least several tweets a day. And I think, you know, spreading awareness that way is really good. We do a lot of incentives, you know, a lot of £10 off, £1.50 off, a free play, etc., etc., as much as you can do, which is successful in bringing in new users for definite. I think wireless theatre is unique in the fact that we strike a balance between old school radio drama and modern audio drama. They do seem to be two quite different worlds, and we are lucky enough to work with some really exciting up and coming audio drama creators and also original radio drama producers who, you know, have worked for 30 years at Radio 4 producing good quality radio drama that's gone out over the airwaves for the last 30 or so years. It's quite a unique position to be in that we are, and I think it's great to mix the two, and it can be sometimes quite interesting working with new techniques versus old techniques, which are quite different, I think. So in terms of commissioning our work, we have quite an open policy for that. We have a submissions guidelines page on our website. We probably make up to 5 plays a year via that process, via some people sending in unsolicited scripts to our website. There is a small team of readers, so it does take a long time for us to get through those piles, but eventually you would hear from us if we were interested in producing yours. We've only just commissioned one very recently, actually, which should be very exciting. Otherwise, we find stuff that's recommended to us. We go and see productions, and we contact writers if we think that their work is nice about getting involved in radio drama. And in terms of recruiting actors, etc., we do that predominantly via, again, Facebook or Twitter, Casting Call Pro, which is a UK-based website, and also through agents, contacting agents and asking who's good and who's around. There is certainly in London, a brilliant, relatively small but brilliant group of really well trained, incredible audio drama actors who, every time you watch them, it's like a masterclass of radio drama performance, who have been working in radio drama for many, many years. And I like to mix those actors in with new actors so that the new actors learn their craft the best way they can, because watching these guys is incredible. You know, it's not just standing in front of a microphone and reading a line. It is completely immersing yourself in that performance, that microphone. And really, I think that's something that you can only learn through experience. So to stop the vicious circle of only being able to get acting work in audio if you're experienced, but not being able to get that because you're not experienced, that's where I think wireless fills a gap, that we are able to offer those experiences in a professional environment. One thing we're always looking for is exciting editors. We have a lot of post-production work going on. We need really good people who understand audio drama as a genre, who can create multi-layered, really exciting soundscapes, filmic soundscapes really, and who can work very fast. We're always interested in hearing people who can do that. In terms of advice about how any upcoming producers can make their work more financially rewarding, that really, I don't know. I don't know is the honest answer. I think that anyone who is creating free content for free, with everyone involved doing it for free, we'll probably realise after a while that that model is just not sustainable, because real life and the need to eat and leave your house gets in the way. But I do think that the audio drama world is changing, and the podcast generation are looking for content very, very fast. And there is a real group, a very hungry group of people who are producing that work. So there is so much content. Certainly the last 3 years, I can't keep up. It used to be, if I googled online radio drama, the only thing I would find was wireless theatre. Now it's I can't count the amount of exciting projects there are out there. So with that, I'm sure will come much more sponsorship and much more advertising revenue, etc., etc., merchandise. And then there is obviously, you know, Kickstarter and Patreon, although I can't imagine it's possible, but I may be wrong, to run a long-term business based solely on crowdfunding. But, you know, we'll see, I guess. I think the best way to move forward is to keep the love and passion of audio drama alive. Whilst that audience is still there, then big companies who have big budgets, like Radio 4, like Amazon and various others, will always make radio drama, and they will always need people who are really good at doing it to come in and do it for them. So that's where you're likely to make your income. But you've got to be really good, and you've got to know how to produce top quality audio drama work. And the best way to do that is to just keep on making it yourself, I think. I think it's so exciting. I've been saying for many, many years that audio drama is alive and well, and has a new home on the internet. For many years, I think people thought I was mad. They thought it was a dying medium. But it's become very clear that that's absolutely not the case, and it's really exciting.
Thank you so much to Marielle for her amazing, inspiring talk there. I just think they get so many amazing guests on here that just say so many things that are inspiring and exciting, really,
totally.
For others to use. And hopefully, if you need to get any more information about their model, seem very approachable, and she's very keen, I think, to encourage, you know, new talent too. So go have a look on their website. It's all on our show notes. So if you haven't found them yet, look up Wireless Theatre. And now, to complement that in a different kind of way, we have a different structure, don't we, Fiona? And who were we lucky enough to break into, walk into our studios in London and speak to a few weeks ago?
It was David K. Barnes, the head writer, and Elizabeth Campbell, the production manager of Wooden Overcoats. Just to say, apologies in advance for the quality of this recording. There were a few people in the room with us while we were talking with them, so there's a gentle burble going on behind our conversation, but hopefully you should be able to hear it perfectly well.
We were hidden behind a sofa, so they didn't see us, so it was all okay.
Hello and welcome to the Audio Drama Production Podcast. I'm Fiona.
And I'm Sarah. And today we have two very exciting, talented people from the Wooden Overcoats programme, which I'm sure that you've heard of, which is blasting its way onto our airwaves with season two currently. Hello and welcome, David.
Hello.
Hello. Yeah. And Liz Campbell. Hello.
Hi.
First of all, to begin with, for anyone out there who hasn't heard your show yet, and they should, can you just tell us a little bit about it?
Yeah, Wooden Overcoats is a sitcom. Most of the episodes are about half an hour. It's a sitcom about rival funeral directors on a Channel Island. Rudyard Funn runs a funeral home in the village of Piffling Vale on the island of Piffling called Funn Funerals, with his repressed and slightly weird sister, mortician Antigone Funn, and their assistant Georgie Crusoe. And they're the only funeral home in the island. They are pretty bad at what they do, but people go there anyway because they have no choice, until Eric Chapman, the sexy young undertaker, opens up his own place across the square, and everyone starts going there. And the series follows Funn Funerals' attempts to get one over on Eric Chapman and all the character drama and gags that unfold from that premise.
Fantastically summarised. Well done. And you're currently at the end of season two, and we were lucky enough to have you interviewed by Matthew with John previously about the season one exploit. So we're just really looking to fathom what differences really have come out now from progressing to season two. So business model wise, we kind of want to fathom really how you've progressed. What kind of successes have you got through creating your current methods of working?
The main one that strikes you for season two would be the Kickstarter, which I think Liz is our production manager. I think Liz would know more about this than I.
Well, I think in short, season one was done very much with no money. It was done on goodwill and favours. There was a little bit of money in that. A studio was rented. That money was recovered by live shows, but nobody involved was able to be paid. It was... Despite the fact that I think Wooden Overcoats has always tried to be as professional a production as it can be. You know, everyone involved is professional, writers and actors and sound people. We weren't at a position season one to be able to pay people. What we've done, what we've always intended to do, is to use season one as a starting point. And in season two, what the big changes are is that a decision was made before we began that we'd only do a second season if we could actually pay people. Because again, these people are professionals, and as such, you want to treat them professionally, which kind of bluntly means they should be paid for their time and talents.
And aside from that, when we were doing the Kickstarter earlier in 2016, we also released special new mini episodes at the same time called Piffling Lives, which were much quicker and easier to make, quite short things to write. Some of them were monologue story based, some were two-hander dialogues. So it enabled us to do a little bit more of only delving into the lives of the characters of the series in the way which we wouldn't normally do in the series itself. It also allowed us to give something to people when we hit certain funding points in the Kickstarter, we could release another one as well. So it gave a little bit of extra momentum whilst enabling us to create something quite exciting along the way.
Well, this is, I think when we made the decision to try and get some money for season two, we really had the thought both A, how we actually get money, and B, how we can do that in a way that would also be a bit of promotion, make sure that the fans are still around so we're not forgotten after a year. And also, I think the idea of kind of give and take. So obviously, we did have this Kickstarter. We were asking people to kindly give their money for something that we'd given out for free. So I think, as David was saying, when we thought of the idea of these Piffling Lives, these mini episodes, it was both a way to keep people on board, to show that we're still doing stuff, and to give back a bit so that when people were giving their money, they were also getting a little bit of something in return, so they'd unlock the next episode when we hit a certain milestone.
Yeah. And how did you come up with the reward section? What process did you go through to get all the things that you wanted your audience to know?
Well, I mean, the Kickstarter itself was, you know, it was actually quite a lot of work. It wasn't, and I promise this to all of our backers, it wasn't just a question of saying, oh, well, let's just ask for a big chunk of money. Mm-hmm. When we decided to pay people, we made a budget, quite a strict budget, thought exactly what we could pay to people that would be fair but still reasonable for us, because obviously we were going from a budget of zero.
Yes.
So we'd come up with, it was £10,000 was our initial working budget. It's been revised slightly, but that's what we thought. We had already set to make some of that money through live shows and fundraisers.
Yeah.
So what we did was we decided to ask our listeners for $8,000. And making the campaign, I think, possibly, we knew it wasn't going to be easy work, but we kind of thought that it would be something that would take care of itself. But actually, Kickstarter is quite a lot of work. We had a long chat about what we could give as reward levels.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
And we wanted to make sure it was something that, well, first of all, the fans would be interested in, but also something that wouldn't eat into our money. I think one of the things that we learned when talking to other people who've done Kickstarters is that if you're not careful, you can spend all your time and money on just making the rewards and not actually on what you need. So if you start promising physical merchandise and stuff, it's possible, but obviously those things have a cost, and then you need somebody to actually design them and make them and send them off. So what we did is we had some recordings from season one.
Well, that's it. When we do our live shows, which are two episodes each time in front of a live audience, they were all recorded by John Wakefield and Andy Goddard, so that we had these as extra. Because all the live shows sometimes have different cast members in, they have alterations to the scripts to suit them for live shows, so they can be different. Yep. We also did a performance at the Old Red Lion Theatre here in London earlier in the year, which had Tom Crowley and Felix Trench swapping roles, and so we had that, and that was an extra thing which we could release as well. We also have our Madeline drawings. Madeline, of course, as well as being a fantastic mouse actor, is also an artist, and so created wallpaper for us. And so the main one, as Liz said, is that we asked for $8,000, but we had this extra sort of, if we get to 10, we can create a Christmas special, and it'd be a full half-hour episode, full cast, scored, written, everything else, just like another episode for Christmas, which would go exclusively to people who had backed us as well. So that was the biggest bonus that we had, and that was if you donated anything. I think it was, if you donated anything at all, you would get that in addition to whatever level you had pledged to.
Yes, I was lucky enough to go to that. It was fantastic. Mm. Fantastic. Mm.
And with those live shows, are they now, obviously partially they're funding what you're doing as well, but do you actually get a great amount of joy as well from those live shows? Are they it's a theatrical part. Is that kind of coming into it now?
Yeah, it's a lot of fun to do them because the series was written to be, there was a decision early on, should it be in front of an audience, should it be done in studio? And if you're doing it in studio, then you do write in a different way. You don't do it necessarily as, you know, there'll obviously still be jokes, but you can explore in a different way. It is a drama as well as a comedy. Once you put it up on stage, I usually go through the scripts and try to add a few more jokes just to sort of pep it up a little bit like that. But we're always surprised and always very happy when the audience respond to the drama just as well. So it's one of those shows that, though it's a comedy, if we go by for 5 minutes of as many laughs, if it's in the piece that, you know, one of these sort of dramatic scenes of two people talking, like Antigone and Erica in a mineshaft, for instance, we know the audience are on board, they get with that. You always get these noises like the, oh, and all that all the way through. It's very exciting and a different experience.
I think we're quite lucky in that I'd say all of our performers, if not most, and certainly our writers, their background is actually stage.
Yeah, mm-hmm. Yeah.
So it was simple enough, and the way that it's written, it's quite a dynamic story. It can be performed live, and it makes it quite easy for us, I think, to adapt it to stage show. And as you said, it ends up being a nice fundraiser. It gets people out. You know, it creates a kind of just a nice atmosphere of support. We're able to sell merchandise. I'm saying all this because I'm aware that this is, you know, a business. This is advice on business.
Yeah.
But you know, it's a good revenue maker for us. I appreciate not every podcast kind of has that. Large cast has that, but live events, I think, they are something that you can do kind of in your off season. They are something that you can do that just brings the fans out, and we were in a very lucky position to have that, and I think people still enjoy, always took out good crowds.
Because you're involved in the Volk Festival at the moment, and how did you get involved in that, for example?
I think for the Volk Festival, it happens each year, and I think it's been going for several years now, and last year, Tom Crowley, who was in, who of course is in Wooden Overcoats, he had a sort of mini season within the vault of shows that he had programmed, and one of them was a play that he commissioned me to write, and did lots of these shows there and got on very well with the people who run the Vault Festival. And so when they were looking for other shows to put on, I believe, at least, I'm not sure if we were approached or we approached them.
I don't even remember, but they've definitely, what they've done this year, they've actually got a podcast week, which is, I think, great, because it does show the potential interest in live shows. Yeah, so there's us, obviously, we've got big cast, but you do have ones that are, seem to be, you know, a couple of people sitting around a microphone doing some interviews, and clearly there's interest out there for people to come and see these things live.
Yeah.
I think it's great to be included in that kind of festival.
And I've been told today, because of the nature of the venue, we can have a little bit more in terms of lighting. So our producer just told us we have some dynamic lighting.
Some lighting.
For the first time, they have dynamic lighting for our radio comedy, which will be, I'm sure, I'm looking forward to it tremendously. It's very exciting.
As you say, that many, all of your actors, I think, have stage work experience and screen as well. Would you ever want to move it into a full-on theatrical production or TV? Or
I think we're open to pitches.
Yeah.
If anyone listening has some pitches,
yeah.
Come our way. I mean, right now I think it's very much written as a podcast. You can do things in audio drama that you can't necessarily do. So the way we view it, I think I'm correct to say, is as a podcast. But the future is exciting. Who knows?
Yeah, that's pretty. It's. I think the general premise, most of the characters would work in any other format, and you work with the restrictions of that format. I've got a stage play that's finishing today. It's on right now, and you know, it was a very different experience writing a comedy in that medium that is for audio. But it is this. If people do, and sometimes people do speculate, say, "Oh, what about the television? Or what about film?" As I said, if any medium, if there was sufficient interest, if the opportunity was there, we'd certainly consider it. We'd look into it, see if it was viable, because they are all opportunities. And so long as we can create something which is as entertaining as the current product, that's what we...
True to our show.
Yeah. Talking about sort of the brand identity of things, we were just discussing earlier, you seem very collaborative group, in as much as a lot of people do a lot of different things to publicise and get this show out there. So we were just wondering how that works organically. Has that just people have fallen into specific roles, or that you've got together and said, right, you're doing this, you're doing this? How has that kind of come about?
I think maybe there's a different answer between season one and season two.
Yeah.
I came on board for season two, where the rest of the production team were already in place. and everyone kind of had their assigned roles. That being said, obviously everyone's got multiple talents. Mm-hmm. I mean, everyone's got different things to bring. A lot of it comes down to us having a big meeting and saying, all right, who can do X? And just people being willing to try things out of their comfort zone. I think my role as production manager has been a bit more, okay, we need to do this. You are now in charge of it. As rough as that sounds, I do think sometimes there needs to be somebody doing that just to make sure it gets done. But yeah, we're a core team of seven on the production team. Between the seven of us, we basically cover every role.
So can you explain a bit more about that structure then? So you say you're production manager, so if you can start from that role and explain for the others, just so that give other people an insight how you work.
I'm production manager. Again, the production team, I don't know if we necessarily have titles beyond what we tend to do.
I'd agree. We've got the creative titles of the show. Yeah. So, you know, obviously you have actors, you have producers, head writer. And I say, I think Liz is the only one with a specific title, I'd say. So when it comes to matters of, say, publicity, when it comes to, you know, sort of organising, there's a lot of sort of sharing involved there. So I think it's more difficult to say. It's much more, this needs to be done. Who at this current time is able to take on this area, or can we feed in various talents into doing it? Sometimes it comes down to which people, you know, this everyone's got, most of them have got day jobs, they've got other projects they're on, so it's which people are free at different times. So sort of Liz oversees a lot of it, and she knows what needs to be done at different points. But as she said, it often comes down to meetings, either in person or online, and saying who's available at this stage to do it. And so everyone is able to pitch in at different times.
I think back as well to the, sort of the use of social media and potentially how successful you've been through iTunes. We've seen you've broken now into the kind of American market in a bigger way as
finally.
Well. So, and so how has that kind of come about? What do you think process-wise has happened to make that happen?
Sheer tenacity, I think a lot of it is. Since Wooden Overcoats launched, there's been kind of constant badgering of the press, things like that. So, you know, we have a kind of active PR side. Every time we have any kind of milestone, you know, we're nominated for an award or we hit a certain number of downloads, just send a little reminder to the press. I think when we began, we had the kind of nice title and the fact that there really wasn't much in the way of, if any way of kind of British independently produced sitcom podcasts. So we were able to make a bit of fuss marketing that way, and we actually did get some nice coverage from newspapers on that end.
Good.
Weirdly, to be perfectly honest, I think in terms of seeing a reaction, in terms of number of downloads, things like that, the press coverage is delightful, but we get a lot more interest when we're, for example, featured on other podcasts, or if there's some kind of internet, you know, if Tumblr suddenly has a good week and covers a lot, we see a lot more download numbers. So for us, it's also about trying to be involved actively online. That's where the good fans come from.
Well, and so, all the listeners and talking to people who make the other audio dramas as well, and trying to connect with other podcasts, because there might be an overlap in audience. People who like this might like that, and you can sort of recommend each other, you enjoy each other's work. There's a lot of collaboration sort of cross podcasts as well,
and that's done through what, through Twitter, Facebook, or what are your primary?
There is a Slack group for the kind of audio drama community. There are a number of Facebook groups, including your own, which are very useful and just kind of keep a it's very easy to keep an eye on what's happening in the community. So even if you're having a bit of an off period where you're not actively pushing yourself, you have your eye on opportunities, see if there's anything that pops up. And you just, you know, we're all in the same boat, I think, the audio drum producers. We're all trying to make the best work we can. Most of the time, kind of in a vacuum, we're all in different places. We're all trying to get by, and there's no set model for the work we do, so it's very easy to create a rapport with the other producers, I think.
And speaking of the community as a whole, many current podcast creators haven't yet got to that point where they are actually monetizing it. I was just wondering whether you had any kind of suggestions or...
I have a lot of suggestions, yes. I think the first thing I would say is that you should always have some kind of opportunity for people to give you money.
Yeah.
I know people can be very shy about money, because obviously podcasts are a free medium kind of by nature. It's very difficult to ask for money for the actual product.
Mm.
And I think there's also a weird sense that people have that, you know, art should be free. I mean, I don't disagree with that kind of emotion, but realistically, you're putting in your time and your talent into these things. And people's entertainment is worth something. People will pay money to go to the cinema, they'll go out. You know,
extortionate amounts these days.
Exactly. Yeah. And think about how much money you've wasted on going to see Batman versus Superman versus the hours that, you know, that you might have enjoyed on a free podcast.
There are very few jokes in that film.
Very few. Except for the
David Kimbon's rewrite.
So this is, and I think that people can be shy, but even if you don't go full out at the beginning with a Kickstarter or a Patreon or whatever it is, put a donate button on your website. I genuinely have had podcasts that I've listened to and loved and thought, I need to give these people my money, gone to their website and found no way for me to give them my money. And you think, what a weird world that I can't voluntarily give you my money. So this is it. If you're not in a place where you can start thinking about bigger campaigns, at least put a donate button on the website. That's advice number one.
And with regards to merchandising, we were talking about that earlier. And so how successful has that been as a brand for you?
We've only just started with merchandising. I think merchandise has been a bit complicated. I think it was a bit, going back to what I mentioned a bit in the Kickstarter rewards, the thing about merchandise is that it does require an outlay. So if you want, let's say you want t-shirts for your podcast, you need to find a way to get t-shirts. So either you buy a bunch of t-shirts, have them printed, but then you need to front that money, get a number of sizes, different shapes. They may or may not sell.
And storage as well.
And storage, and then, you know, there's hidden costs. So you have these t-shirts, you need to package them before you send them. You need to send them to maybe different countries.
Yeah.
There's things like, you know, VAT. If you're sending to certain countries, you may have to deal with the taxes. But, you know, there's money that eats into it. And, of course, somebody's time in actually arranging all this. So physical merchandise, if you do it on your own, it can be quite a lot of hassle for not a lot of reward.
Mm-hmm.
There are stores and online places that will let you know, do it for you, but even then you're making quite a small amount of profit. Now, that's not necessarily a deterrent, but it's certainly something to consider. What we've tried to do so far is rely on what you might call merchandise that's not physical.
Yeah.
So we have, again, with Kickstarter rewards, we made sure we had recordings.
Mm.
Obviously, that's something that we have. We have it.
Mm.
And it's there, and we can put it out. One of the things that we've got now is, of course, our Christmas special.
Mm. Yeah.
So that was something that we got through fundraising for the Kickstarter. Everyone who gave the Kickstarter got a copy. And we've stuck with the philosophy that it should be for anyone who gives us any money at all can get it. So now there's a donate button on our website. You donate anything, you can get access. But what that means is it's something we've made. There's no more, you know, cost for us, there's no more outlay, it's there, and in theory we could have it up there indefinitely, generating a small amount of revenue. So I think in terms of merchandise, if you want to call it that, one of the nice things to consider is ways like that, things that don't require an outlay in the same way. But we do have physical merch. We bring it to live shows because we don't have to send it off. And people seem interested.
Yeah, badges are always very
popular. Badges,
we have
everyone
a
loves
lot of badges. And people like them because they're also sort of a moment of, I saw that show. Oh, this reminds me I saw that show. If they want to tell their grandchildren one day, they'll have the badge.
Yeah. When we're very rich and famous, it'll be sold
on eBay.
You've
also, in the series, been doing amazingly funny sponsorship.
Yes.
Yeah.
Do you want to explain a bit about that?
I mean, from what I know, that we were approached. Are we allowed to name the sponsors on the
back?
I think we are.
I think
we put a few of the episodes of season two were sponsored by Bruno Mattress. So a Bruno Mattress, yes, a Bruno Mattress Rudyard. And they wanted to, for short adverts, and I said, could I? We the whole production team had to chat about how it would be best to do them, whether it would be just somebody coming up saying, you know, hello, my name is Felix Trench, I'm in Winova Coats, and I think you should sleep in a Bruno mattress. And I thought, well, actually, what should we do in universe? And I've been inspired by back in the day, especially comedians and comedy shows, when they were advertising something, it would be like those two people in universe saying, they do some jokes and then they say, but I'm eating these crisps, my word, tell me more. And there's something so, there's something, just a lot of fun about them, because you can tell that they're very tongue-in-cheek and yet they're still very serious. You still get information across. And so I just had a lot of fun coming up with these ways of advertising this Bruno mattress that would still be part of the show, which you could do very quickly. That would also be really, what our main thing is, we wanted to come up with an advert people would actually listen to and wouldn't skip over. And so if you make it entertaining, people will listen to it. And hopefully they will end up going in, over to Bruno's website. Bruno Mattress. I can't say it more often enough.
BrunoSleep.co.uk/windovercoats.
But they did. And so they did, they did four of the episodes. And otherwise, we also had people, I believe, if they donated particular to Kickstarter, could have a mention as well at the beginning, so that other businesses that help. So there have been a few different ones as well. But it's just a way of trying to give something back to those who've helped us a great deal, but also make it entertaining at the same time.
And it works.
It is quite the mini saga in that Rudyard's quest for a decent night's kip.
So, I mean, that's one of the main differences, I guess, from season one to season two, having that kind of... Are there any other big differences, do you think, between how you've approached season two?
On that way, I could really speak creatively rather than sort of business. So how useful that is, but creatively was simply... all the toys are there ready for us to play with. What new things can we do with them? How do we develop the characters more? How do we come up with something where it's not just, and here's the same characters doing the same things? Do we come up with something new? And that's why at the end of season one, I decided I'm going to have Antigone say, right, I also want to run this with you. Off we go.
Yep.
And then I thought, well, then you need to follow that for the second season. You need to actually develop that. You need to, one of the things that I did in the first season was I thought, well, maybe Georgie and Eric might have a romance. And then by the time we actually got to the episode where we did that, I thought, actually, no, I think it should fail. And then keep that as an overrunning thing. And so for season two, it's taking those and then pushing them further and developing new, just because, let's say, it's also it's an audio drama as well as a comedy. Mm-hmm. The characters must develop in some ways. The joy we've had is that the core content seems to be elastic enough that you can push it and change it without it breaking. So, we couldn't just have Roger saying, oh, I'm off and leaving, because that ruins the show and it would end it. The way we've approached it is to, I think, we've pushed the drama a little bit more in places while still keeping it funny. The last episode, of course, episode 8, was an hour long rather than half an hour, because there was a lot more story we wanted to push into that. You do have the episodes where Antigone basically sort of takes over one, and then sort of Rudyard takes over a different one. Georgie had her own. So it was just, exploring all those characters, exploring the context we've got in new ways, where the audience think this is still new. It's not just the same season, but with different gags.
Yep.
I think in terms of the business side...
Which is what you're actually here to listen to.
Well, yours is far more interesting. In terms of the business, I think the hope, at least from my perspective, was to try and find a way to make this sustainable.
Mm-hmm.
Whether we're there or not is another question, but I think we've again, made great strides from going for zero budget to actually being able to pay everyone. What that means, though, is that it does change your relationship with people a little bit, in that when you're no longer operating off of goodwill, you have to make sure, just as if you're paying somebody, you expect them to turn up on time. In the same way, if we're paying somebody, we have to release them on time. That's how it works. So I think it does change the relationship a bit. There was obviously concerns. We made a budget. That had a calculation on how many actors per episode that we could afford. I gave David 8 episodes in a Christmas special, and as he said, the last episode was basically 2 episodes in one, which was just fine in the end. I'm teasing him, but it was trying to keep things on track, on budget. It does what we never wanted to do was limit David or the writer's creativity in what they could have, but obviously there are considerations, and it was things like, okay, well, this character is only briefly in this episode, we have to try and record their lines on a different day when these other people are in, so we don't have to get them back, first of all, so we don't have to drag them into the recording studio every day, but also because then we have to, be honest, pay them a second day. So little considerations like that. I was trying to keep a tight rein on the budget and make sure that expenses are kept to a minimum, so I think it went from being just a complete group of lovely friends doing a thing to now hopefully still a group of lovely friends, but there's that always kind of undercurrent of trying to treat it like a business.
Yeah.
You do have several writers working on the show. Mm. How do you determine, is there any conflict when where the show is going to go when you're discussing it?
Or, in terms of creative decisions?
Yeah, creative decisions.
There doesn't tend to be. I'm a horrendous dictator, so they... And on the whole, actually, no, on both series, the writers sort of sat around the table. They've usually had a script to read, or season two, they had a whole season to listen to. They wrote some of them themselves. What I tend to do is to say to writers, come up with a few ideas of stories you'd like to do. I know that whatever my sort of, the arc of the series is going to be, I will make it work somehow. And so I say, what would you like to do? I tend to have a few ideas myself, but I store them up. So I find out what everyone else is interested in writing about. Like, if it's a ghost story, about a seance, or somebody wants to do something about, Antigone and Rudyard in conflict over this particular thing, and I think, right, that's what they're excited about, X, and I'll let them do that. I don't want to force them into a story they're not interested in. They'll do that. I can always come with different ideas, and I'll fill in the gaps. Season one, I had four writers, all of whom said, I want to do the Antigone episode, and they all did. So I'd say, right, well, I won't write any scenes of her then for the whole series, and I'll just do all of Rudyard's. The season two was a bit more balanced. Somebody wanted to do one of Rudyard Antigone, somebody wanted to do something of Eric. So for that, there's never really a huge... It's always very joyful, those meetings. We don't have many of them because of time commitments, but you sit down, they all come up with what they're excited about. I go, excellent. If you're excited by that, then I will be as well. And then I fill in all the blanks and I shape everything as well. And it actually doesn't take a great deal of time if the drama is... I always say to the writers, come up with a really interesting, dramatic core to it, a dramatic conflict, because we can make that funny. It's very easy to make sure that is tied into a wider... arc. You just need a little bit of tweaking. Sometimes, like, take out a line and replace it with another, does it? You just need to keep an eye on it whilst not limiting the writers too much.
So if somebody who is a writer who's quite isolated, how would you suggest, how did you find these other people that you...
I am desperately isolated. Today's the first time I've seen sunlight in 5 months.
I think you're smoking.
I a fleet of carrier pigeons goes out and finds the writers, many of whom I've either worked with before on other projects, or have been recommended to me. Sometimes you just see a show. For season two, for instance, at the Vault last year was a show called A Grey Wing House, which is on again this year, with Moni Beth Morosa. We watched that. I really liked it and said I think she'd be an excellent fit for it. We give it more of a gothic edge. For the season as well, James Hamilton, James Huntrods. I met James Huntrods at Tom Crowley's birthday party, and he's a comedy writer, and he had his writing partner, and I met them and talked to him that way. But I knew that they had done lots of excellent work before of their own shows. They also did Hector vs. the Future podcast. They were on Amazing World of Gumball's Cartoon Network, so they have a different, and so they had a very different way of writing comedy. People like Tiff, T.A. Woodsmith, called Tiff because that's how she also calls herself. I knew at Goldsmith's, Christopher Hogg in the first season, I knew at Goldsmith's, Cordelia Lynn was recommended. So they always have this different, it's not always writers I know personally, it's people come up to me and say, I think you should check out this writer. And there always are the writers I want to work with, it's just the number of slots we have available, and if somebody's done a really great script, of course we want them back. Tom Crowley, of course, is an excellent writer as well, always relied upon to be able to knock out a first draft in an indecent amount of time. It's a lot of different talents. My job is to funnel them all in the same direction, and to impose a sort of a common structure to every piece, so that if you listen to an episode, you go, that still wouldn't overcoats, even if somebody else has written it. Yeah. And to combine that structure of a sort of uniformity, but enough of their own voice as well.
Yeah, it also keeps it fresh, I'm sure, in a more exciting way.
You get very interesting, you get really new ideas. If you've got a group of other creative people telling you, we really love this aspect of this script you did and we want to explore more of it, go, oh, fantastic, excellent. Then they'll come up with something entirely new. Running gags are developed through that. I think even one of the running gags, Eric Chapman and his past a long time ago developed, I think that's Tom saying to me, Dave, can Eric say a long time ago a lot? Because I think I do it really well. I go, Yes, you probably were, Tom. And then we put it in. So things like that will develop. Sometimes if an actor just wants more lines, and I'll stick him in.
You can blame.
Yeah, I'm all right. That's fine. Here we go. Have a monologue. Brilliant.
And you talked there about the time scale and fast writing. So how much do you have to be strict with time scales and that kind of thing, especially with the payment and things like that?
It's, a whole series. For seasons one and two, they both took about 5 to 6 months because you're doing it around other bits and pieces. I find that most of my work I find easy to write when the other scripts have come in, because again, I can find out, you know, a writer will say this is what I want to do, and then they'll submit it and like a draft or a second draft, and suddenly I realise that what seemed like a Rudyard heavy episode actually has loads of arguments for Antigone, and that might be the same as something else. So they definitely have deadlines. We try to stick to them as much as we can. In terms of things like payment, that tends to be fine. I think the rule we do is a writer's script is officially finished once it was up in studio and actors have done it, because at that point they can't be expected to do any alterations. So that's fine. But you do have to stick. I mean, the main deadline is recording dates. We have a meeting where all the scripts are read out. We have to make that. We've got the actual recording over. Series 2 was 5 days with a weekend in the middle. We've got to hit those. Scripts need to, enough needs to be known about characters to cast people if we need new actors.
Yeah.
So John and Andy would always be, okay, we know you want a clown in episode 8. Mm-hmm. Can you please, for God's sake, tell us anything about it? I'd say, yes. So often a scene would be written in advance. Like I wrote the clown scene about a month, 2 months before the rest of the episode, just so we could cast it.
Well, I think that's, in terms of the scheduling, it's not so much from my perspective about things like payment, but it was about when we made the decision to have a second series. We obviously made the decision, said, well, we're going to need to find the money.
Yeah.
But realistically, we needed to get some balls rolling before we knew the money was in place. So while the Kickstarter was going on, David was already busy talking to the writers, trying to get things in place. We already had to see if, you know, any of the actors couldn't come back. We couldn't, you know.
Yeah.
So, and there was always that thought in the back of our head that it's quite possible that no one will give us any money.
Yes.
And that this will all be wasted effort.
Yeah.
But you kind of just have to take a gamble on it. And it worked out in the end. And it was fun. But it is that kind of, you've got to keep to the schedule, and unfortunately sometimes that schedule takes a bit of risk taking, but it worked out.
Well, yeah, because at least like 50 plus people are involved in across the series, obviously.
Yeah.
So that's quite a lot of
people. You sort of, one thing I try and do is work out in advance how many characters an episode we'll need and which actors. Sometimes, I mean, one episode I was writing fell through because it just wasn't working, and I felt, well, I need to replace it with a new script, but it's got to have the same cast because we've already booked them. So you go, right, sure. And then I just came up with a new idea for the episode, got those actors involved, or switched one to a different episode and juggle it that way. But there is a lot of advanced planning. And one thing, sort of, as being head writer, is if something doesn't work, or a writer says, actually, I didn't use that character, I went, oh, God, right. Try and use them somewhere, or I'll put them in another one, because you do need to stick to that. Give them a lot of freedom, but once certain things are locked in place early, they need to stay there, no matter what happens.
And say someone is starting out in specifically comedy, what kind of advice would you give them, considering perhaps mistakes that were made initially or things that you'd prefer not to have done? What advice would you give someone?
Don't write a sitcom with a cast of 25. Really. You're an absolute maniac. Look at the... I mean, one thing we did for season one was we did say, OK, do we want to have, like, 10 actors and multi-voice, half the cast?
Yeah.
And then for some reason we said, no, actually, you know what, let's think really big and let's get all the actors.
Every single actor.
Actors who some actors have only like 3 lines across the whole series. But you know, I think it was very much a let's think big, let's do what other radio comedies can't do. If we're going to do it independently, let's take advantage of that and give something that you wouldn't get somewhere else. And one would be full cast, lots of actors, etc.
It was ambitious. I think there's times where I listen to other very brilliant audio dramas that are quite clearly three people in a room.
Yeah. One place. Yes.
Oh,
yes.
That must so much easier to do.
I think certainly look at your restrictions. Don't, you know, it's always good to be ambitious, but too much ambition will kill you.
Yeah.
But we did make it work for Winnow Goats, and for season two we just said, are we going to do the same? And they went, yeah, because we've set it up and why not?
Back now, we're
Let's
still.
Go forward. And I mean, I obviously, as a writer, I enjoy, you know, most of my background has been stage, where you tend, especially in London, plays will be a cast of 1 to 4 because you can't afford any more than that. And so you work within that restriction, unless you're working on a, you know, and you play for the National, and you do have to stick to 4 actors or less. But for this, having background characters who would have a couple of lines per episode and then suddenly jump up and be a main character for an episode is a really enjoyable thing to do. It's fun for the actor as well. A great deal of fun for the writers to play with that. I would certainly say, you know, look at the... If you can make it easier on yourself, if you can have only a few locations and a few actors and still make a great story, then do that. If you must have more, then account for that. And just one thing I'd always say, certainly, is if you're, say, doing a comedy, if it's a sitcom, have a really great central situation which you can get lots of different versions out of. You know, if ours is just two different rival businesses who hate each other, and we could have taken that in lots of different ways, but we've done the way we did. But there's lots of stories that can come out of that. We've got lots of stories that we could still do. So always come up with a concept which isn't going to just last an episode and then you go, oh God, where does it go? Always have a concept which you can push much further.
Thank you so much for all your time and for your expertise. It was fascinating listening to you.
Yes, and where can people find you? Where, if they, for some reason, have crawled under a rock and haven't heard you yet, where on earth could they help donate?
www.woodenovercoats.com is where you will find us, and on the various podcast providers. And we're also... We are contactable at hello@woodenovercoats.com. If you have any questions, very happy to answer them. It's my own personal plug right there.
Yeah.
Shameless plugging.
Fantastic. And obviously to anyone in the London area who want to go and see you live.
All the details will be. There's a listings page on woodenovercoats.com. It says all the live shows that are up and coming. And we're Facebook, Twitter. Flag people to taxis down in the street, ask who we are. They'll give you an answer. It may not be useful.
And we'll also put it on our page here as well.
Excellent. Wonderful.
Yeah, so here's to season 3, yes?
Yes.
Fingers crossed.
Fantastic.
Thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
Thank you ever so much to our brilliant contributors today. It was... Very honestly, a real pleasure to chat and to hear such useful and fascinating information.
Absolutely.
Thank you.
Yeah, no, I think you've got some wonderful things to think about. So if you are potentially going to use any of those models, as they've said, you know, are open to chat. So do communicate with them if you feel you need to know any specifics from them. And check out what they've done, as we said earlier. Find out the models that are successful that you think might work for your podcast, because different strokes for different folks, you know. That aside, I mean, there is on the podcast host website, there's some really fascinating articles as well. One we read recently by Richard Brooks, which is basically about, you know, listener engagement and promoting your podcast and how to really think about the business models that are right for you, which is, you know, we've discussed them really today. The Woodenovercoats obviously talked more about their live performances as well, and if that's something that works for you, like no sleep and so on and so forth, then go for it. I'd love to come and see some more live stuff for sure, and one day maybe we can do this live and your mum can come. But yeah, I think there's a lot of fun things to be had in the articles there, so please do take a look at some of those podcast host links.
That's it. We'll put them up again on the website. It's www.thepodcasthost.com. And in fact, there's an article there from Matthew.
Hooray!
Yay, Matthew! Cool. Looking at which host you could use to host your podcast. And he, in fact, looks at Libsyn versus Blueberry. So have a look there if you want a comparison between the two.
Thank you so much to all of our amazing contributors, and we wish you good luck in audio Waking Land. Feel free to contact us if you've got any questions on Twitter, on Facebook, on our lovely forum. Hello, people on our lovely forum.
Hello.
And just to say as well, there's really good ways of helping to publicise your podcast that are growing by the week. You should be hopefully jumping on the bandwagon of hashtag Audio Drama Sunday on Sundays, not like Saturday like I did one day. And I was keen. I wanted it to be Sunday. And Caitlin from the Liberty podcast. Yes, Caitlin set up, basically it's a gridded square like you'd find at the bingo. And there's a free space in the middle. That's not the name of a podcast, Kessie Rilinki. And basically you need to see how many lines you can get on this audio drama bingo. And it will hopefully introduce you to some new podcasts that maybe you didn't know about. So have a little look at hashtag ADPodBingo. And that's kind of doing the rounds at the minute. And we will, I'm sure, be seeing another bingo card for you to have a look at, finding some new exciting extravaganzas in audio elsewhere. Yay. On the net.
Yes, get a full house.
And of course in March it's a hashtag tripod. So have a look on that one and see what you can try next. There's loads and loads of brilliant stuff at the minute. And I am very immersed. I'm swimming in amazing podcasts.
Yes.
Stories all over my head. It's quite messy.
Yeah. No, there is just an amazing array of podcasts out there at the moment and all of those events. So, yeah, do get your hashtags out and get promoting each other.
In public or in private. Yes, it's all fine.
It's a rising tide that floats all ships or boats.
Yes, so whatever floats your boat. Woohoo! Well, on that note, hope you're enjoying your life. We're very excited to have spoken to you. Thank you very much for listening.
Thank you. Goodbye.
Bye-bye.